Ray O.
My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic and member of the Miami Men's Group. I don't think it's his fault. He seems to have been born that way. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. And I want to tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss this. This is a thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in the Bronx in New York City. And my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you may not understand it here in Portland, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. A difficult thing to think about, but true nevertheless. And if you looked at where I lived, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker, and in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, he stood out. So when I showed up at the local place and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. Just another O'Keefe coming through the system. I don't really recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. That was a neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. And I liked the way it smelled. And I liked the way it tastes. And I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I liked the fistfights and the Irish music. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. I think I just threw the signer off her pace over there. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all of the difficulties and troubles you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake in a small school up in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood, and I went off to college. And when I got up there, my drinking changed. There were no bars in that state, just restaurants. And they sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs. And they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. And I learned the words to some of those songs. And I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over, and it was a safe bet. And things were relatively slow on the campus. So one day I got a haircut, and I joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco. And I hate to be indelicate in such a large gathering, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and a new man slept on top. Don't get ahead of me, pal. This is not easy here. I went on my first liberty in the city of San Francisco, and I came back with all the beer in me I could buy. And I went to sleep, and I had one of these attacks. And I met the fellow that slept below me that night. I guess he thought he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him that it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. And the rest of my naval career was just as distinguished. And I returned home some years later, undecorated, unhonored, and unloved. And everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was absent without leave from the New York City Police Department. Billy had invited a citizen of the Puerto Rican ancestry off a five-story roof, and the citizen had bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. So Billy went west and went into a more peaceful line of work. He went back into the Marine Corps. The government was giving veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when a very clear thought came one evening. I remembered that I'd been in college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard and I walked into this place and there they were, sitting around the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. And now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was relatively solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. And one day I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition and I noticed a list of names on the bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. So I notified the widow of this great event, and she came north. And that was a very tender sight, the widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. About 10 years later, I served as a trustee of that school, and I'd go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. When I came back home, the question was what to do, and my uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had been, and that's what my brother was, and that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. Well, I told them I wasn't going to do that. I told them I had my own plans, and I had received a scholarship to law school, and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions, but that's what happened. I went to law school, and I didn't know anything about lawyers or law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops, and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that has made Don Mucci Grosso a wealthy man, but when I arrived at law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These guys were deadly. They all had on a blue suit and they all wore eyeglasses. So as soon as I got into uniform and I got a pair of glasses I didn't need, and I looked around for someone to drink with, a companion, but nobody drank in that crowd. They're all studying. They're all grinding it out. So I went on the wagon for law school, and I didn't drink. And as a result of that, I did well. And when I came out of law school, I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. Oh, really? My superiors there determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer, and so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that all the very smart guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I got a little priority on the phone and a line of credit, and I learned to drink in a different, a more civilized, more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this minute, my love, my affection, and my admiration for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. After about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a lady, or she had located me. Who knows how that works? And we were married right before the war. I'm not talking about World War III. I'm talking about the war between me and Mrs. O'Keefe, which has continued now for 33 years, and I've been losing all that time. And we settled down and set up light housekeeping, and Mrs. O'Keefe began then to deliver children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion. And with the regularity that is known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after about the second of those events, I received a phone call from the law school I had attended. And I was invited to see the dean, and I went to see the dean, and he appointed me to the faculty. And I became Professor O'Keefe, and I responded to that appointment with great alacrity. And there I was, the boy professor. If I had known Don was on his way, I would have quit the second day. Now, I was very nervous about that position, but I really wasn't sure what there was in my background to justify it. It was very prestigious. And I knew I drank too much, so I decided to cut back on my drinking. And I tried that for a couple of years, but it didn't work out. But after a few years of teaching, it occurred to me that I was competent to teach. I was able to do it. I knew how to do it. So once I figured out I knew how to do it, there was no point trying to stop drinking. So I went back out to drink the way I really like to drink. My father died when I was 2, and my brother Billy was 4 years older than I was, and he was not at all like me. He was tall and good-looking and handsome and athletic and all of those things. And Billy was my hero, and I tried to do everything just like Billy, and I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something happened to interfere. I would see people leaving. I'd wonder where they were going. My God, the whiskey was right in front of them. They were going out the door. Missing a great opportunity. And this period of time, too, Ms. O'Keefe and I bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village in New York which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to 6 or 7 kids and the usual number of motor vehicles and the usual memberships and the usual obscure clubs, and because of my position at the school, I have been appointed to a number of commissions and councils and things like that by the governor of the state. I had even run for public office at one time and lost, and I was moving around the way lawyers who are on the make do, and I was a member of everything. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. As a matter of fact, I would have told you I was doing very well whether you asked me or not. It's one of my favorite themes, was the American dream. Truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had turned into a daily drunk. And my day would have killed an ordinary citizen. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed, because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of that damp sack, and I'd begin my morning aerobics. My aerobics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, the water in a shower, and the water in a tub, and the water in a sink, because I did not want Mrs. O'Keefe and all those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would come downstairs in my sincere blue suit, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry, because Mrs. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. If you can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I would take a few bangs on daddy's juice. And then the question was, would I throw up in front of all these people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I get into New York City to Grand Central. And I don't know if you know anything about Grand Central, but it's really not a railroad terminal. It's primarily a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I would tear around the tunnels every morning and pop up like a mole here and there and do a repair job. And then I would head for the school, and as soon as I got into that imposing institution, my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out, I'd tear across town, and I'd steal. Every morning I'd steal $20 from a law firm's petty cash, and then I'd be in business, and I'd go back down to the courthouse, to the bar across the street where I really belonged. And I would buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and a bartender would buy a drink, and we'd all buy a drink. It was marvelous. And we would get nothing, absolutely nothing done, but it was terrific. And I had it figured out in some peculiar alcoholic way that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock. So I scheduled the classes for 2, and I'd zoom up to the school and inflict myself on those young sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet. And I would shortchange them as best I could and zoom out of the building and get over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12 and take a train that was going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont where I lived. North was good enough for me. And I ended up most times in Connecticut. But sooner or later, I'd get back, and I'd come in the house and bounce off a few walls and take what was left of daddy's juice and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in those days in that house. And evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very fond of civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab ass with the ladies of Larchmont and a sorrier looking crop you have never seen. Most nights I would just stay home and vegetate, and I'd try to watch television with one eye like that and try to get those sets to come together. And I would go through the programming and through the news and on into the morning. And finally, my big moment would come when they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And the destroyers would be coming through the water. And they'd be playing that song. And I would cry. Oh, I would weep and sob and cry. And then I go upstairs and wet the bed, and that's it. Another wonderful day. Well, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I would pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she is my wife. How much can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney. And I would explain that to her because she is fairly dim. And I would also explain to her the relativity of drinking, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. And on a relative scale, I was not a very big drinker. As a matter of fact, I would tell her, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much as your mother. And then I would have to leave and go away because she had offended my mother. I would go see Mom. And so it went. So she betook herself to a physician one day. And as you might understand, her physician is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And he had many things to tell me, and he sent her home with the message. And the message that she brought me from her physician, the obstetrician, was that her husband, the professor of law, was an alcoholic. I was overcome with outrage and rose to defend myself, as was my custom. And I launched into one of my jury addresses. And the first point I made was fairly sane. I thought I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice all too common in our country today. Then I went into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. At this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a very fast rate. And then it happened. And I don't know how this happened. I can't explain this to you. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I'm giving you. But in the middle of all of this yelling and noise, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe for the first time I'd ever admitted to anyone that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity because in addition to everything else going on, none of which was any good, it happened also to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing through. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president.
Ruth, could you get him signed?
He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. And he worried about the security. And he went away and he left me. And so I spent the next week or so doing all those warm, wonderful, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook, I sweat, I did everything else wonderful that you can think about. And I finally popped up for some air. And then I was visited by the staff of the hospital. They was a very, very fancy rattle box, as befitted a man of my stature. And I was visited first by the head of the hospital, and I would have expected no one less. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me, and he asked me that question that many, many people insist on asking alcoholics. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him. I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him how Mamsie and Dada used to travel a great deal and had left me in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And I had become insecure and turned toward alcohol. And he was very sympathetic. And another one came in about an hour later, and he asked me the same question, so I told him of my impoverished youth. Told him of the beatings I had received at the hands of my drunken mother. Even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years of age. He told me I had come to the right place. Said help was at hand. Said with his help and with the help of medical science, one day I would drink safely again. He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And the last one in to see me, and the last psychiatrist I have ever seen, except for one I used to drive to meetings from time to time, who managed to kill himself. This last one was a gentleman of dubious medical qualifications and a pronounced Middle European accent. And he was fascinated by two things. One was my professorial status, and the other was the fact that I was wearing sneakers in January. We had a long chat about the footwear, the relevance of which had escaped me completely until he brought it up. But I was happy to discuss it with him. And then he popped the question at me, the same question, and I gave him a sexual aberration that drove him out of the room. He thought he had been given a great degenerate to work with, and perhaps he had. Well, I wasn't that smart. They had a staff meeting, and they came to the conclusion that there was a fraud in their hospital. And so I was summoned into a very large room, and in the middle of the room was poor Mrs. O'Keefe, hysterical. And she told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. I said, "Let's go." But she prevailed upon me to stay. And I was engaged in a very excellent form of therapy for the disease of alcoholism. I was playing Monopoly around the clock with three guys who were there. They weren't alcoholics, they were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do pretty well. And I had the boardwalk, I had a number of hotels, and things were looking up. And I was enjoying the therapy of it all, and I wasn't drinking, and very successful at Monopoly, and began to see some glimmer of hope in it all. And they said I had a visitor, and I went into my large executive type-headed cell, and I waited for my visitor. And through the room, through the door of that room, came this very, very imposing man. And he told me he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital had given up on me, and they had asked him to speak to me of this program. And I immediately reverted to my origins because I almost had him by the throat. I said, what are you, out of your mind? And I started with him. And he told me to shut up. I immediately forgave him because I knew that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I began to tell him who I was. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking fella, and I was not a well person. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat, and he began to explain to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, what his life had been like, how he had come to this program, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to a meeting. And I said, do you mean outside, sir? He said, outside. I said, I'm going. Besides that, he gave me matches. Nobody else had allowed me to have matches. And so that's how it began with me. That was in January of 1963. And he did all kinds of things for me and arranged for me to go locally. And I came home and I started to go locally. And I don't remember so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills they used to insist on giving alcoholics. And I was walking around. My head buzzed a lot. But I knew myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president when I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. And you would give me a plaque, and that would be the end of it, another happy chapter written in an already fascinating life. Well, it should come as no surprise to you, but it was a terrible shock to me. To find out some 10 months later, I was very, very drunk. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference because I had turned away from the great power that is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stayed drunk for a period of time, and I won't take you through that. It just takes too long, and it still gives me the willies when I think about it. Just let me indicate to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I would drink a week, I wouldn't drink a month. I would drink a month, and I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings, and then I would drink. I never knew when I would be drinking and when I wouldn't be drinking. And I certainly never knew where I would end up once I began drinking. And things began to happen to me that had never happened before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time, which I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law, and that all of the honors and all of the positions and all of the prestige and all of the dollars that went with that position were taken from me in about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was a serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but this is not what I am speaking to you about. What I now speak to you about is that there happened to be in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing I could do about it. I had been here, and this did not work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else, I'll tell you. I've been through the hospitals and the drying out places and the farms and the sanitariums and the doctors and the nurses. And I've been through the jobs and the friends and the politicians and the money. And I was up and down every avenue there was, and the result was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about alcoholism. I knew about alcoholism. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I remembered those people who went bad, as we used to say. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew about alcoholism. I knew what was waiting for me. And if I gave this any thought at all, I suppose I thought, well, if that's the way it is, then that's the way it is. And I continued to drink. And truly, truly, as I am before you, I did not think that I would ever stop drinking. But my time came one day. One day, my time came. And I don't know any more about this than you do, but it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are simply not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line would be for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and a personal thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They called one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and the man said that Billy was dead from alcoholism. And he had died in that hospital where they had taken him when he collapsed on the skid row of Minneapolis. And so my brother and my hero, died the way alcoholics oftentimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something trivial. But I know that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it, we must. And I arrived on a day that really wasn't much different from a thousand other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was in this place where I worked. I was nervous. I was thirsty. I was going to go get a drink. And I was given the great grace and the great opportunity to call a longtime friend of mine and a longtime member of this program. And his name is John, and he is my sponsor. I told him what was going on, and he came over. And he came through the door of that room, and he looked so good. And I felt so bad. And I asked him how it was. How could I become as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he gave me that look that he has. And he said, don't drink. Go to the meetings. You'll be all right. Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want him to tell me that.
Please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop the machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine.
I told him the real problem was this place where I worked. Said a lawyer of my talent should not be in a place like this. He said, well, don't drink and you go to meetings. You might get a little better. I told him at home it's worse. I mean, I can't even go up there anymore. Well, he said, don't drink and you go to meetings. You'll be all right. Told him I was being sued by a bank. He said, yeah, well, don't drink and you go to meetings. That'll work out. I sensed there was no dialogue there. I am a lousy sponsor. I could never be a sponsor like this guy. I would say to him, I don't feel well. He'd say, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. I'd say to him, when am I going to get a good job? He said, you had one. I'd say, I'm nervous. What am I supposed to do? He said, hang on. I said, how do you hang on? He said, let go. He took me over to Grand Central that day, and he stuck me on a train, and he had made some phone calls, and I arrived up there, and standing on a platform of the station was my mailman, a guy named Al. And he said, "Get in the car." I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." Said, "Somebody call me about you, stupid. Get in the car." Oh, a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fist fight with a mailman, or anybody else for that matter. I get killed. I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I'm in a lot of problems, Al." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink." So if any of you are foolish enough to seek my advice, because I'm from out of town, you want some advice? Don't drink, all right? Go to a meeting. Sure, yeah. Al took me up to the group where Don and I were members. Then I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And that was November the 24th, 1965. And first... first I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day. A drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And because they were so very grateful for what this fellowship had done for them, they gave me a day. And I am convinced that because of the gift of that one day, all the other one days have managed to accumulate. And they got me going. I went to a meeting every night. I saw Al every night. I saw John every day. I got my instructions. And I still go to a meeting every day. I go to 9 meetings a week. And I like every one of them. And I don't even count these things as meetings. I'm just up here sort of entertaining. Real meeting is in your group, around the table, with someone who's new, breaking them in, showing him the path. That's a real meeting. This is the icing on the cake. Real meetings in your group, with your pigeons, your babies. Going down the path. I was hanging around about 3 or 4 months and doing pretty good, I thought. And one day he grabbed me and he said, "You know, the trouble with you is that you're ignorant." By now I was used to him. I said, "Please tell me in which respect you find me ignorant, sir, so that I can hasten to correct this situation." He said, "You think that Alcoholics Anonymous is for drinking. You think Alcoholics Anonymous is to stop you from drinking." I said, "Yes, I did have that impression, sir." The name of the organization would give such a clue, I said. And he fixed that look on me. You know that look that long-time members of AA reserved for smart-ass people? Yeah. He said, "Drinking has nothing to do with this. Drinking is nothing." He said, "You are here to enjoy a spiritual awakening, and I don't think you have a prayer." He said, "Read the book." And I said to him, "I have read the book. Rarely have we seen anyone fail." And he stopped me and he said a very bad word. And he said, "Read it again." And only in order to conclude that conversation, I said, "Yes, John." Because I knew from experience that the only way to get rid of him was to say, "Yes, John." And I did. I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I was appalled at my initial ignorance. I had no idea that book had been written about 5 years after Bob and Bill met. No idea that 100 or so men and women had recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. No idea that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book, which were read for us by George tonight, were steps literally taken by men and women as they became sober. And after all, what is a path but the steps of the people who have gone before along that way? Thought when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe and I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step of this program. Oh, that's my name, I'm an alcoholic. But the men and women who founded this great fellowship did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable. Their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all the same thing with them. They were powerless. They had no power. They were without power. The book tells us that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for me. And if you come here new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that that power could restore them to sanity. This was not just a casual opinion that they shared. They really believed this. This was part of them. And as they believed, I believe. I believe that there is a power greater than my own. And I believe that that power can restore me to sanity. And so firm and so true was that belief that they were able to make a decision. And they decided to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in. This God, as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright. Because at a time in the history of our country, when no one else had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual. A disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking with that first step, they found that their bodies responded. And when they came to believe that there would be some hope for them here, they enjoyed a mental recovery. And when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. And lay down a basis not only of a spiritual recovery, but the basis of a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were smart enough to know that it isn't any good to stop drinking and start praying. That doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They could be searching because by now they were relatively clear. They could be fearless because they had made a decision to entrust their life into the care of a God of their understanding. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That's impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. for all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. And in my case, that fear was really terror. This program helps with that. And when they were finished with that inventory, so great was the love and the affection of these people one for the other, even as I observed the love and the affection of you, one person for the other. They were able to admit that inventory to themselves, to the God of their understanding, and to someone else. It was a great relief for me to bring this to my sponsor. It was he who explained to me the exact nature of my wrongs. And then they developed an attitude which came a little hard for me. They were entirely ready to have God remove all these character defects. And with compelling logic, they went to that great power that they had come to believe in, that God is their understanding. And they humbly asked him to remove their defects. They spoke to their Creator and they asked him to take from them the good and the bad, all of the things that stood in the way of their being useful to him and to their fellows. They gave it to us as a prayer, as so many of our steps are really a prayer. I knew and I was instructed that there was in my life, as there was in their life, a great deal of wreckage. And so, as they did, I wrote a list of all the people I had harmed, and I made amends, became willing to make amends to them all. And these people went out and did it. They didn't talk about it, they did it. And you may recall from our literature that Dr. Bob's first day, Bill drove him to the hospital. He worked on someone's rear end and got home late that night. Bill asked him where he'd been. He said he was driving around Akron, Ohio in his old Buick, mending fences. It was his first day of not drinking. He was making amends. I don't think we need wait so long in this program to do everything that's required of us. Especially when the benefits are, as you know them to be in our book. It says that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. It says we will enjoy a new freedom and a new happiness. It says we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. It says we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I am able to report to you, my brothers, that each and every one of those promises has come into my life, solely and wholly because I am a member of this great fellowship. And by this time, these men and women were fairly sober, and the book says that there had been a restoration of sanity. And they knew, I know they knew, that what had been given to them was something very precious. So they resolved to maintain it. They continued to take personal inventory, and when they were wrong, They promptly admitted it. They knew they could not enjoy the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful, because if they were, they would drink, and if they drank, they would surely die. So true and so great was their reliance upon a power greater than our own that they sought to improve their conscious contact with God as they understood Him. They did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers. They prayed. And no one needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. When they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. I can never know how it was with you, but it always seemed to me, from the time I was very, very young, I had a terrible feeling that I did not belong. Ruth spoke of it. I knew I was in the wrong family. I knew I was in the wrong system. I was in the wrong school. Everything was wrong. I did not belong. I did not enjoy it. And in my case, that feeling persisted and was very strong, even though I was moving through it all successfully. I was a successful kid. I was a successful student. I was successful at my work. I did not belong. And this feeling is very strong with me. And it centers here somewhere. And the wind blows. And it makes the days very long. And it makes the nights very dark. And then I came to you, and I learned to pray. And in the 12 and 12, it tells us in the chapter on prayer that perhaps one of the greatest benefits of prayer is the feeling of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer lost, or frightened, or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence to the contrary in the world around us, we understand that a loving God watches over us. And we know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I am able to tell you that that sense of belonging has come to me. When I tell you that I am Ray O'Keefe, an alcoholic, and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm really telling you who I am, what I am, and where I belong. It's a good feeling. It isn't so much that you invite me to speak at this great gathering. I belong here. I'm supposed to be here. I knew from the minute I got here that I belonged here. Next week it'll be somewhere else. I belong there too. I belong here. I fit in. It's okay here. And prayer did that for me. And a great thing happened to these men and women. They learned another prayer. They prayed to God to give them peace of mind. You and I already have already prayed that prayer. They asked simply for peace of mind. They asked God to give them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened. Something happened to these men and women. Something has happened to me. Something happens to everyone who comes here, who puts this program into their lives, and puts their lives into this program. There was a great difference in these men and women. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober. There was a great conversion of their values, a great substitution of their standards. And this difference, the difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were helpless and hopeless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And all they were really using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that great power, and having had that great experience, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffered. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in September of 1987 in the great city of Portland, in the state of Oregon. And that, my dear, dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew what my sponsor knew. They knew what all of us know. There is much, much more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous than a simple device to keep people like me from drinking. They knew what had been given to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of living, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. So, where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so. Where they had been, as I often was, very dishonest, they tried not to be so dishonest. Happily for us all, they said we weren't saints. They said it was a program of spiritual progress, not a program of spiritual perfection. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and go to the meetings. You'd be here until next Wednesday if I had to tell you everything wonderful that's happened to me since I became a sober member here. If you have a good wish for me, and I know that you do, please be assured that anything you might wish for me has already happened in my life. every single thing that alcoholism took from me. Every single position, honor, relationship, dollar, all of it has been replaced in my life by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in ways that are so mysterious and marvelous that I don't even think about it anymore. Everything that was once is back in place. And to give you an indication of how the O'Keefes are doing, I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of six of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got my eye on that other one. I am one of the members who gets around a lot. I know that some of those tapes flow through your estate. And everywhere I go, I say the same thing. And I don't make any apology for that. That's just how I do it. And every time I end the same way. I talked to you about a pamphlet that is very dear to me that we have called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, the author takes, at the very end, a biblical turn. And he recalls a time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin, Jesus, as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him. And one day they stopped him, and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for thousands of years? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really did not answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk and the deaf hear. And tell John that the sick are made well and that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And we all know that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear brothers, in happy convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that experience, it seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again. Through the longest of days and the darkest of nights, the good news of this program, brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.